Hello, my name is Dr. Vanessa Kimball, and I am a baker. But I'm also someone who has studied and researched the impact of bread on our health for many years. I run the Sourdough School in Northamptonshire, and my specialism is bread and the gut microbiome and the impact on our mental health. But I'm also trained as a nutrigenetic practitioner, meaning I look at the way that bread impacts people according to their genetics. It helps me to personalise bread. And in this podcast, I'm going to be chatting to someone who I hope you are going to find as interesting as I did. What I'd love is for you to listen and think about the bread that you bake, eat, and share with your family. Because bread is a staple, it's our most basic food, and I believe it is the foundation to good health.
Yep. So we are going to inoculate koji. Koji is in Japan. The Aspergillus oryzae mold grown on rice, and it is the basis of the whole world of Japanese fermentations, from sake to miso and soy sauce. It has definitely become a backbone of what we do here in Noma, in terms of developing flavors and being inspired by those same families of ferments. But we make ours as Scandinavian as possible. It is the same species of mold and its relatives, but it's grown on Danish barley. So that's the translation, if you will.
Do you grow it?
We do. And this is what...
This is what you're doing now. You're growing it.
Yes, exactly. So just give me 1 second. I'm just going to wash this out. And get started.
This mixed koji spores at first glance looks like a chocolate rice crispy cake. It's kind of interesting. It's got that kind of texture and it's broken up. David, when you were a kid, did you ever mix milk chocolate with rice crispies?
Milk chocolate with rice cookies. That is something I have never done.
That's a special thing that you do in the UK.
Okay.
It looks, from a distance, they look like kind of something you would buy at the local village fete. It's like a cake made with rice and chocolate. And then you get a bit closer and you can see that there's gradually
a in Canada we have something called clodhoppers, which is, I think, rice and other things all mixed together with cocoa butter and flavors, and yeah, it kind of looks the same. The mixed koji spores, however, are us crossbreeding two different strains of Aspergillus. And so we're actually, we kind of are farmers here in a sense, and you know, you have your lineages, and if you try and coax out different flavors, you'll end up having to either breed a line in a certain direction and kind of direct evolution, or try and crossbreed and see if you can influence flavors that way. So that's what that experiment was, and it worked to, you know, some success or another. But we're always playing around and trying to see what stones haven't been, you know, overturned, if you will.
So explain to me again the process we're doing right now, because you've pulled out what is effectively looks like something that I've been using in baking to kind of spread out icing sugar.
Yeah, yeah, it's a little sifting canister. And so I've loaded it with koji tane, which is, in Japanese, the spore of your koji, what you would use as a mother to inoculate the next generation. Well, I can just show it to you in the actual cup. But that's what it is. So this is sporulated koji. It's probably not too good to breathe it in, because that's how you give yourself aspergillosis.
Oh, okay.
But,
okay. Is that bad?
It can be. It can be.
I really like smell. I smell everything. I'll be fine.
Oh, that's fine.
And that you buy this, do you? This is something that you buy in from someone who specializes in this in Japan?
Yes, exactly. Okay. This is a company in Japan that does this, and they're very good at it. So this is where we got our original spores. What we're going to be working with today is a strain of koji from Awamori, which is in the north of Japan, and it is a black mold. It's a black aspergillus mold. The kojis that you normally see go into sakes and things like that are usually either green or white. But this is a kind of a more ancient character here. And what we're interested in this, or why we're interested in this mold in particular, is because it produces citric acid. And so for us, this is a very handy tool, because being from the Nordic region, we aren't able to, out of Danish ingredients, really make lemon juice. But through this kind of cheat of fermentation from barley, we will end up with a product that is quite sour, has notes of stone fruit, and this deep, dark color.
Do you always have to start every single koji with something like this, or can you just start a koji and then move on and keep on using this to recreate it like a sour starter?
In effect, it is the exact same. All cells come from cells. These are lineages. You can't make a puppy without a dog. And it's the same thing for these molds. So yes, they are in effect mothers, but what you have to understand about working with things like koji is that they are different throughout their lifespans. When you take something like a koji mold all the way through to its reproductive stage, where you would use it or be able to use it to inoculate your next batch as a mother, its flavor changes. We like stopping it at 48 hours because we find it's produced the enzymes that are necessary to sweeten the barley. It's developed enough flavor of its own, and it's good for our purposes. By taking it an extra day and getting those spores to kind of pop out, it's the fruiting body, just like a mushroom. The flavor kind of bitters a little bit and diminishes, so we want to catch it at just the right moment, unless we want to take it through to the next generation. And the koji that is the bulk of Restaurant Noma is a white variety of Aspergillus oryzae, and we have been growing our own and carrying it through generation after generation for not as long as our sourdough bread, but we've been carrying our koji mother through generation to generation for at least 6 months now, at the very least, without having to go back from the spores that we got from Japan. So it has its own character, and it definitely has changed from the store-bought version that we started with.
David, how do you stop it from going in? I mean, just so that you kind of find it 48 hours has done what it needs to do. What do you do to kind of go, hey, stop?
You put it in the fridge.
That's it.
Or you freeze it.
You lower the temperature.
Exactly.
And that's just, so in much the same way as
yes.
Controlling
its growth. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. And koji does like a very warm environment. We keep it in a room that's held at 33 degrees and 80% relative humidity. So it's a bit of a sauna, but it makes for a very happy environment that the koji just takes off in.
So I've kind of seen that it's been done, and it's done when I watched it in Japan. It's an incredibly steamy environment. It's almost like a sauna.
Yeah. Exactly. And we have recreated that same environment downstairs.
Yeah. Do you go and hang out with there on a cold day?
No. No, it's a bit too much. It's a bit... You come out a little too sweaty.
Okay. So, you've got the workbench here. I love the fact that this is a laboratory kitchen. It's just
yes.
A little crazy.
It is.
There are... Just describing it, really. There are kind of... beakers that you would expect to find in a laboratory, school laboratory. Yep. There are blackboards, there are kind of like some fairly scary looking machines and hoses underneath me. I don't want to know what else you're doing here because it's a... Okay, so just to paint a picture. What is that?
That is a rotary evaporator. A rotovap, for short, is its brand name. But this is, in effect, a distiller. You see it a lot in chemists' laboratories, but it's also pretty handy in a lab like this where you need to isolate flavors or, you know, extract volatile compounds, either to make your base more palatable or to trap them themselves. And so a good example of what we do with this, we'll go out and forage fresh, young Douglas fir pine trees, which have these notes of grapefruit and citrus, and blend it with a little bit of alcohol, run it through the rotary evaporator and catch the distillate, and you end up with this floral, piney, foresty perfume that we actually use to scent the hot napkins here in the restaurant to kind of, as the first thing, just bring you into our world.
It's a world that actually is incredible, and we're going sort of from the forest back down here to sort of microscopic level again.
Indeed.
So tell me about the flavours that this adds. In the koji, I personally use koji for the zone. Playing around with chickpea and sourdough koji. Actually, got to hold my hands up, that wasn't my idea. That was actually Richard over at Tartine's idea. He's been kind of grinding up some stuff, and so, yeah, it's quite interesting. But normally I kind of just kind of go and buy it, my koji.
Yeah, which you can, but it is easier to grow than you'd think. So long as you follow a few simple rules. You know, it might not grow to its full potential, but you'll probably still get it to work just all right, even at room temperature in your kitchen if you just take care of it and keep it moist. Yeah, but I've actually got a couple for you to taste over here. So these are two that we use in recipes at the restaurant. We have Aspergillus arise and Aspergillus lucuensis. So this is the arise, and this is the guy that is and has been for the past maybe 4 or 5 years of restaurant Noma, to me, the flavor of Noma.
Smelling it first, it's got a sweet flavor. It's got a sweet smell.
It does have a sweet smell.
Do you know what it reminds me of? It's kind of like really grey mushrooms.
It is a bit mushroomy. I mean, they're related. It's a fungus. But I find it has these notes of tropical fruit, pineapple, and, you know, like mango rind.
Okay, I feel like I'm a child in Willy Wonka's chocolate factory right now.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I don't know, I've eaten a lot of things. I've never, ever, ever eaten anything like that before.
No.
That's just... I'm speechless.
That's good. That's good.
That's not good for radio, so I have to just find my words. Well, first of all, the texture.
Which is a fun texture.
It is. It's like, I want to eat more. Yeah. I remember myself really stupid.
It's a good snack.
My kids? Oh, I wouldn't be able to leave this alone.
Yeah.
I'd have to be dipping in. Mm-hmm. I don't know how good this is for you, but I would be... It wouldn't be there.
Very good for you. I would say.
Okay. So it's almost like eating actual bubbles.
Yeah, a little bit. So the mycelium grows through the barley that has been steamed and is just loosely fluffed. So these are individual grains, but as the koji grows, its webs spread through all the barley and hold it together like a cake, but not so stiff that you can't chew it apart and end up with this lovely texture in your mouth.
Bouncy.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like bouncy pearls.
Yep.
And the flavour, it it has got a softness to it. There's something really feminine about it. It's soft, it's gentle, it's kind of... Do you know, there's nothing... I can't compare it to anything. I just happen to have it. Can I have another piece?
Absolutely, go for it.
Okay. There's all... What did you compare it to the first time you ate it? What do you think is that there is just nothing to compare to this?
I don't think... I would say the reason why it's become the flavor of Noma is because the first time you try it, you're at a loss for a metaphor. It really is this otherworldly flavor of its own distinction and character and scent. And it's delicious.
I know exactly what it tastes like.
Oh, what's that?
When I was a child, I used to imagine reaching up into the sky and grabbing handfuls of the fluffy white clouds as they passed by. Mm. And I actually think if I had ever reached up and grabbed a handful of the fluffy white cloud, this is what it would taste like.
I would agree. It's cloud-like.
Yeah. Cloud-like. Defies any other description, I'm afraid.
Yeah. And so this koji ends up in a lot of our products. We make our misos from it, but we use, once again, Danish ingredients and make our misos with split yellow peas that are grown here in Denmark. And then with the barley koji, you end up with this amazing umami-rich product, much like the Japanese have their soybean miso, but once again with all these Scandinavian bases. We'll ferment this again, blend a water out of it, and lactic ferment it to sour it, like you would sauerkraut. And then strain that of its juices and use that almost like a flavored sweet and sour fruit vinegar, if you will. This ends up in our garums as well, because the enzymes that the mold is produced, the protease and the lipases, help break down animal flesh. And so that kind of replaces the animal guts in our garums and ends up with this cleaner, lighter flavor, which we prefer. And so it is...
The lipids, you can taste that. It's got fat in it. It's got something rich in it.
Lipase, which is an enzyme that helps break down fats.
So what is that richness in it then?
I think that's just the deliciousness of a complete taste, really. I'd say that the koji is probably very low in fat. I mean, it's just the grain, and then...
It's bizarre, because if you said that that had fat in, I would believe it.
Oh, absolutely.
It's got that satisfaction. It takes very well to... it's got that satisfaction.
Yes.
That's what I'm... Yeah.
Yeah.
There's no more often I get a new experience, David.
Ah, that's good.
But that's...
We try and facilitate them here at Restaurant Noma. But let me introduce its cousin. So this is Aspergillus leucuensis. And this is something that we've only really... discovered the potential of maybe just a couple months ago.
That smells different. It's more lemony.
So this is a variety of Aspergillus that, in its metabolism, produces citric acid as a byproduct.
Right, okay. The lemoniness, I can smell. It's got the same texture.
Mm-hmm.
It's got that same mouthfeel to it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
But it's a whole...
Wine. It's almost like... it's got that... Yeah, you're right, acidity, but it's almost like like an apple cider vinegary kind of back note to them.
Yep.
Yeah. You see, I didn't have any trouble describing that one. No. Apple cidery back note kind of vinegary clouds.
And when we work with this and make liquids out of it, I basically either making a stock... like the Japanese would make amazake, or just blending it with water and then straining it afterwards, you end up with something that tastes very much like the perfect blend of oyster mushroom and a pink lady apple. And as a juice, it's delicious. You could drink it on its own. We've played around with making kind of like quick alcohols with it, and those are delicious. They're not for sale. We just work with it in the lab.
That's your excuse, is it?
Of course it is. Of course. But it's an absolutely unique and delicious tool. I would say that the overall flavor of this is less complex than our Orize barley koji. But it is a citrus fruit that you've just never had before. And that's cool in itself.
While you're talking to me, I'm holding this in my hand and I've got a piece of it. And from a distance, you just kind of look at it, except that it's kind of clustered together in white. But as you get really close up to it, it's incredibly pretty. It's almost as though it's sort of got this teeny tiny fur over it.
That's exactly what it is. Exactly what it is. So as the koji grows, it runs its web through the grain, and starts releasing these enzymes to break it down and soaking up the nutrition by breaking down the starches into simpler sugars, disaccharides that it can digest quite easily, and breaking down the proteins and the protein coat of the grain so that it can absorb those as well.
So it's basically making its own sugar.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. But then after it's grown its mycelium and kind of spread its web, it starts producing its spores and shooting upwards, like a mushroom or a morel after a forest fire. And if you were to take this, this one is only grown for probably about 32 to 36 hours.
This is another one at 33 degrees that you kind of keep
in. Exactly, exactly. But if you were to take that through to 72 hours, the color would go dark brown as those stems of the spores shot up. And you ended up with spores that were colored a little bit differently than our sister koji over there. It's not white, but ends
and
up
then
being
then would you use that for the next generation?
Exactly.
So, to me, if I was doing this on a domestic kind of level, I would kind of take half of it and put it in the fridge and use the other half for my next batch.
Yeah. You'd probably need a lot less than half, though.
Okay.
1 teaspoon of the spores, pure powder, contains around 1 billion spores.
Wow, how much have I eaten? I've got about 5 million spores in me.
So it is a fairly fecund organism. It's a mold, and as anyone with a refrigerator knows, mold grows.
I'm going to ask you a question, and it's going to be a strange question. Don't be offended, but I did a program recently where we were asked to try a new root, which is a probiotic, like a celeriac root kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And after we'd eaten like our third and fourth slice of this cake, they told me that it was going to give us terrible wind. And all the ladies at the table looked absolutely horrified and went home and nearly blew their husbands out of bed. Does this have any effect? Am I going to suffer?
I don't
this?
Know. No, I think you'll be just fine.
It's okay. So you didn't have any notable effects as
no.
such?
No, other than your desire to keep eating it and cooking with it in every way, shape, and form.
Don't worry, I'm sleeping alone tonight. It's, yeah. So that's incredible. So you're going to do this right now. Would you take a piece of this, let's say 72 hours old,
mm-hmm.
and then you'd add it back into, is it cooked barley?
Yes, we soak the barley. We rinse it after it's soaked of all the starches, like you would with sushi rice or anything of the sort. Then we steam it. And steaming it keeps the moisture level just right. If your barley's too wet, like if you were to boil it in a pot, it would just get a little bit too soggy, and you'd end up drowning the spores.
You're keeping it intact.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. But if it's at the same time undercooked, it's not wet enough to allow those spores to kind of do their work. So you kind of need a perfect middle ground, and steaming works quite well.
And you let it cool, or do you add it in hot?
You need to let it cool. It's an organism, and not all organisms like volcanic underwater vents. So this one is happy at just around room temperature. So we let the barley cool after it comes out of the oven, and it's been fluffed to around 33 degrees, and then we start working with it.
Is it like oxygen?
It does like oxygen. This is something that you need to keep aerated and well humidified.
There is quite a remarkable similarity.
It is. It is. And you know what? Yeast is a fungus as well. So, they're probably not too far off.
How many different species of fungus, koji fungus, or aspergillus fungus have you been working with?
Have we been working with?
Yeah, I mean, you've got what, 12 up here?
It's kind of been, oh, well, some of these are doubles, but it's kind of been my pet project to really expand this repertoire, because to me, this is one of the most powerful tools for just different dimensions of flavor. When I started in the lab, we were just really using the Aspergillus oryzae, which, like I said, has been the backbone, but now I've got two different varieties of citric koji, an albino, and well, this isn't the right term, but a melanistic strain. We have kojis that are specialized in breaking down proteins that we use for our own, you know, quote-unquote soy sauces. And like I said, I've been trying to crossbreed them as well, so taking this and that strain and seeing what offspring they produce. But it's a work in progress, and not all of them are necessarily fit for what we want to do here or interesting enough to use, but you just kind of have to pick and choose and see where the strengths lie with each different species.
I'd say I'm hooked.
It's easy.
Yeah, just like, you know, this is just like when I was a kid, I used to kind of like, it sounds terrible, but if there was some milk going off, I used to kind of lick it and go and hide it under my bed and watch it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, and all the different colors, this is kind of that on steroids.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. People come over here and they're like, what do you do? And I'm like, in effect, I'm a farmer with billions and billions and billions of plants.
I love it.
It's a fun metaphor. But anyway, I'm going to start inoculating this so you can see the process.
Does it only work with oryzae?
No, you can effectively grow this on just about any grain, so long as it's polished. Now, we use pearl barley because the pearling removes that outer husk. And that is important because the koji does have a difficult time running its web through that initial shell. This is probably good because this is something that, well, a grain is a seed, and it's the next generation of a plant, and a plant has an invested or a vested interest in protecting that seed. So a grain's husk does exactly that. It makes sense that a fungus would have a hard time getting through the husk of a seed because funguses are plants' biggest enemies. But if you have a human to remove that husk for it, the koji takes off. And so we actually have a grain polisher here, and we've tried over, you know, some months trying different grain, different Danish grains.
That's what this is.
Exactly. So you put your grains in through the top, and it's almost like a mill, and it runs the grains through a drum with varying levels of coarseness and spits the husk out to one side and the polished grain out to the other.
You know, all the instructions are Japanese.
We're good at trial and error here in the lab. And plus, we do have a couple Japanese chefs that work in the kitchen, so we're all right.
So can you just buy pearl?
Yeah, it's a very easy ingredient to come by.
But you're not that easy, are you?
No. But no, this is, we have tried a lot of different barleys, because just like anything, just like bread and sourdough, the grain that you start with, the flour that you start with, has a very large impact on the product that you produce. And it's the same thing for this. And so just by, you know, ordering through different suppliers and seeing what was available to us, we ended up with an organically and biodynamically grown Danish barley that has a lot of its husk polished off, which makes it much easier for the koji to grow. It makes for a cleaner flavor because the proteins in the outer coat of the grain can tend to take on bitter notes. And so the more of those you shave away, the cleaner your flavor at the other end. Exactly.
Okay. That's very interesting. That's fantastic. So we've got a tray here, and I'm just looking at it now. It's a metal catering tray. You've got about 2 inches of cold, cooked, steamed pearl barley in there. And it's actually very beautiful. There's this ray of Danish summer sunshine across it.
A rare occurrence.
don't tell me that. It's gorgeous, and it's cold. I was expecting it to be
still steaming. No, it needs to just chill out to about room temperature, and then it's good to work with.
This isn't a 5-minute job, is it?
No, not necessarily, but it's not a long job either if you kind of get into the groove of things. I'm going to begin, so we have
to stand back now because I'm going to get like
you'll see the cloud, and a funny little history about koji. There was actually a distinctive desire to breed the Koji into an albino strain. The white variety is actually a mutation that just produces white spores, and I think one of the big reasons why the black is its native form, or its ancestral form, because the black powder just gets everywhere. And there are actually stories of, you know, sake makers in Japan who were just got tired of working because they'd come home just looking like they were covered in soot at the end of the night. But this is ours, and well, we just bear with it. But you'll see.
So this is the Piso room. It's kind of like the holy temple of the fermentation lab. But we make, in effect, our own misos here at Noma, but they're not misos in any traditional sense. We don't use soybeans. We don't use rice koji. And we definitely don't do it in the traditional style. We use split yellow Danish peas and our barley koji that you saw me make earlier. And together, those things become piso, a funny little name that Lars came up with because he had to call it something. But it is the backbone, another backbone of the flavor of Noma. You could call koji the backbone because there's lots of koji in piso. But it's umami, it's a thick, rich paste, and it makes vegetables transform. You can smear some on a little bit of cabbage, throw it on the barbecue, and you end up with this unctuous, crunchy, smoky leaf that's in its own class. You don't even need to compare it to meat. But that's what we do here. The fermentation lab has always kind of had this underlying mission to kind of exalt and elevate vegetables, and these techniques are really what allow us to do that. Yeah, so this is kind of the standard variety, original flavor, if you will. This is just piso. Over here we have some that is ready, should be ready here. We're very close to it. I'll have you taste some.
These buckets, if you like, see through. It's allowing me to look and see exactly what's inside. And what's very interesting here is that you've almost got like a layer upon layer of colour going on and texture. So we've got almost like a sort of white mould on the top, and then we've got a sort of a mixed layer here of kind of light brown and almost looks like Marmite.
Yeah.
And then there's a level across here which is cream and kind of bubbly, and then there's a liquid. And underneath that is almost like, say, almost like lentil soup.
Yeah.
So does this what does this tell you, David, these kind of layers that are going down? Because the fact that these are not just buckets, these are see-through buckets.
Yeah.
That must be important.
Not necessarily. I wouldn't say that light, and I mean you can turn the lights off in this room, it doesn't really matter. The see-through buckets are nice just so you can see what's going on, or you can see the color, you can see what mold is growing. These ones up here actually are first batches of real shoyus, real soy sauces that are made in kind of the same style as piso, with peas instead of soybeans. And they're working fantastically well. This is with a new strain of koji that's much better at breaking down protein than just the aspergillus oryza that we use for cooking with at Noma. But they're really, really delicious, and they have deep, deep flavor. But these are just the first test batches, and once we figure out what we're doing, we'll kind of up production, and if the test kitchen likes them, we'll start making more and more, you know, buckets of 25 liters, so on and so forth. But I'll let you taste one after, but the one that has dried sep mushrooms thrown in it is particularly good. I'll have you taste some of the piso here. So you keep it underweight, underneath the plate, to just kind of keep the air out. It does need to breathe, so it's not like we need to age these under vacuum.
The temperature in here, for making miso, do you need to keep the temperature like this when you're making miso normally?
In Japan, you would make miso and it would just happen.
Yeah.
as it happens. It's just ambient. It's whatever temperature it is outside. That's your miso room.
But in here?
In here, it's 30 degrees to kind of speed up the process.
Is that... I mean, Japan isn't sitting at 30 degrees. It's got quite an ambient
problem. Oh, parts of it are. In the summertime, it gets quite hot. But it does just kind of fluctuate. I believe in Japan, they kind of start it in the fall or winter, and that kind of gets it off to a slower start when the bacteria, the yeast, would be the most active. And then once they kind of settle down in the summertime and the heat kicks in, you know, the miso's kind of stabilized.
That's quite interesting. It's a little bit like when you slaughter a pig in autumn, because you want it the opposite. You mm-hmm. want it to be cooling down.
Yeah, yeah. So we only use 4% salt in our misos, which is enough to keep it safe and keep malevolent bacteria out. But it's also a very low salt percentage for miso. Normally you could go as high as 8 or 10% salt, which is a very salty paste. Too salty for our purposes in Noma. But it lends the piso a very tart, sour quality to it that I think suits our food very well. You know, we are looking for this acidity. We are looking for this lactic flavor in our food. And by going that low and allowing these things to age for that amount of time, you definitely achieve that.
That's very interesting. Can I have another little bit?
Yeah,
because,
sure.
I have been playing around with miso, and I've been tasting various kind of unpasteurized misos recently. And that is the most outstanding miso I've ever tasted. And one of the reasons I was about to say was because the first thing you normally taste with miso is the salt, and this is not the first thing you're tasting.
No.
In fact, this is, again, it's another complex, gentle, almost quite seductive flavour,
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
and it's sweet. It's got an absolute sweetness to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a light... it doesn't even taste kind of heat. It's just sweet. It's Do you know what? You better hide that bucket, because if I find my way back in here with a spoon, I'm going to eat half a pot of that. It's absolutely delicious.
Yeah.
Plus a dashi pea, so you put dashi in with this?
Well, yeah, we just started. It was another test that we were doing, but just starting it off. It's a basic recipe. We just, instead of using just plain water, we use a seaweed stock, which kind of just ups the umami and makes it a little bit rounder and so on and so forth. But it is a pretty straightforward, and it is vegan as well. It was such a meaty taste.
Dave, what happens over time? Do the flavors kind of move from sweet into? I mean, what would you expect to happen during its? If you taste it like from day one on to.
It starts off like a very pea puree.
Yeah.
It starts off with the salt much more forward, and then it'll get a little bit sour at the beginning. It still tastes very fresh, and then as it starts drying out, as it ages, you start slowly, slowly kind of entering this world of umami, and it gets darker and darker, and you notice this, like, caramelization start happening over the course of months. If you were to leave it in, our pisos normally get pulled off at around 3 or 4 months. That's kind of where we like them, where you really start seeing this darkening in the color, and, you know, this like, it just kind of almost dries in and just concentrates the flavor. We've let them go longer just to see what happens, and you really do get these very dark, deep tones. If you've ever had hacho miso, kind of like that, but less sweet. Because I think the sugars really start breaking down.
Sorry, say that again. The sugars
start breaking down even more, and you start losing that sweetness.
I interrupted. I'm sorry, can you just say that whole sentence?
Yeah, so if you were to let them go even longer, let's say to 6 months, you'd notice them get very dark in color. They get very earthy tones. And Lars always taught me that you can burn things very quickly in a pan by having a lot of heat over a short amount of time. And if you were to graph that, if you were to graph the amount of heat over time, you would have a peak. And if you were to take the area of that peak, you would have burnt. But if you were to also cook something for a very long time at a very low temperature, the area under that curve would still be the same, and you would still have something burnt. So you can achieve these dark, roasted, caramelized, burnt flavors by aging something for a very long time, letting the Maillard reactions happen slowly, versus burning them in the pan. So you can actually burn miso by just letting it sit at 30 degrees for 8-10 months. It's a little bit hot, and especially for a salt content, you would have that much activity. But yeah, we like catching it at kind of that just right point where you start developing these, just the first hints of these flavors.
So scientifically, what is going on? I mean, I'm trying to think how many buckets you were here. Well, maybe, have you got 100 buckets in here?
No, I don't think that much. Maybe 50, 60. Okay. I haven't counted.
What's happening inside of them, David? On a micro level, what's going on?
The koji plays a big part in what happens in our piso. So we grow the koji to 48 hours, and at that point, it's produced all the enzymes it needs to really kick itself into its reproductive stage. But we stop it before it reaches its reproductive stage. But at that point, it's produced a lot of amylase. Amylase is an enzyme which breaks down amylose and will turn long chain starches into disaccharides if it's beta amylase, or maltose, something that's very sweet on your tongue. And it creates lots of protease, which helps break down proteins, chops them up into free-floating glutamates, or that's what you register as the taste of umami. Much shorter chains of amino acids that your body just loves to taste. So as the miso sit at this ambient temperature, which is much lower than kind of the highest activity point for these enzymes, all these enzymes start working their way through this thick mixture and acting on the proteins and any sugars in the peas and the starches as well. And it all just kind of ends up breaking down. You can even tell by the texture. You know, you could have a whole pea go in, and by the time it comes out, it's pasty. And that's because it's lost its structure. The starches that keep it together, that give it its form, end up getting chopped up. And with that, you have a Maillard reaction happen at the same time. And all these kind of lockstep aging processes make for this umami flavor that you register as, you know, deep and delicious and dark and sweet in miso.
When you stop the koji and then you add this in, you're effectively kind of stopping it and restarting it.
The mold isn't growing anymore.
So the mold's finished at that point. At that point that you actually put it in the fridge, you're just... That's it,
bump. If you were to put a koji mold in the fridge after 24 hours and take it back out and put it back into the room, it would start back up. But when you mix koji mold with 4% salt and then pack it down with peas and it can't breathe, it's done with. It's not going to grow anymore. But there are lots of lactic bacteria that do kind of grow symbiotically with koji mold on barleys. You can notice a sour note. If you have the right temperature and humidity with your koji. And so those things will keep working once they're in the piso as well. Nothing's as cut and dry in the microbial world as you would think. There's always a slew of microfauna that are working away in whatever ferment you have, and the misos are no different.
So if I ask you to summarize in just a sentence the role of the koji in here, what is the actual role of it?
A reverse assembly line. A disassembly line. That's what the koji does to the peas, I would say. You put it in there, and it's via the koji that you end up breaking down the peas into something much greater than themselves.
Which bit of the koji? Because if you've, like, as you said, when you put the salt in, you've killed off the sort of initial...
The organism. Yeah. Yep.
Which bit is it that then is then working?
The enzymes.
Okay, I've got it.
And so, it's a funny thing that, layman's terms...
I'm just thinking that, so you've got that, it's the enzymes that are working rather than the actual...
mold itself.
Yeah.
Yes, okay. Yes.
Can you just say that as a whole sentence? Because that's something that is, I think, fundamental to the understanding of what's going on. Yeah. I'm sorry to be... So tell me again, so what is, what's happening, the koji, what is it, if you can summarise it in a sentence, what is the koji's role and what is it actually doing in there?
So I would say that the koji is a reverse assembly line in the process of a miso. You mix it in with the peas, you throw it into a bucket, keep it under weight, force the air out, and while the mold is dead at this point, while the salt kills it off, the enzymes that it's already produced keep working. Enzymes aren't alive. They're products of living organisms, but they'll work long after oxygen's been removed from an environment, long after salt has been added. You can denature them, you can destroy their ability to function, but the enzymes that the koji produces are really the active participants in the process of miso. They're breaking down the starches in the pea, they're breaking down the proteins, and allowing all these byproducts to become the delicious flavor that you understand as miso.
The two different enzymes that are in there, they're not two different enzymes, there's lots of different enzymes, but they break down into what kind of enzymes there, so there's more than one. Mm-hmm. Well, can you give me a...
So there are proteolytic enzymes, ones that break down proteins, and then amylase, which breaks down starches into simpler disaccharides. I was just looking for a word for, like, the whole family of them. Like, I don't know that word. I know proteolytic. I don't know. Amylytic? Is it I don't know.
Yeah, it's all that. Yeah. It's, I just walked in here and, you know, probably know by now, David, that I'm a chatterbox. And in actual fact, I'll tell you, it's like a secret. The more chatterboxy I am, the often more nervous I am. You know, some people go quiet, not me. I just... I can hear myself in my head going, shut up, Vanessa. You know, I can hear it. It's a little voice going, shut up. But, you know, it's just one of those... It's like a... It's almost like a defence mechanism. Sounds silly. But I walked in here... And I was... I was quiet, and it's almost, I feel like, you called it a temple, but I feel quite reverent in here. I think that just walking along these shelves, looking at the labels, you've got elderflower piso. I'm assuming that the elderflower brings those floral notes in.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, it's flowers mixed through the piso, so yeah, it comes out tasting quite sweet, though we've added no sugar.
A citric piso.
Test. Not working so great.
Now this one is incredible. This is a coconut piso. Now, interestingly enough, the coconuts will also have their own kind of thing going on as well with the enzymes, and obviously that's been fermented, so this is a second fermentation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And does that bring more complex flavors than that?
The cocoa nib's actually not that good. It's not that tasty. The cocoa powder was very interesting when it was younger, and now it's kind of leveled out and just become dark. But that's the other thing, is that it ferments our living processes, and something might start off interesting and then get boring, or something might start off boring and then get very interesting, and you don't know until you've done a batch and understand where all these things are leading.
So, David, how often do you come in here with a spoon?
A few times a week, just to see how things are doing. Just to taste the kids' progress.
So I like the fact this one here has this label, and it's a little bit of masking tape that you put over it.
Yeah.
And it says cocoa powder piso, and in brackets it's got the one to watch.
I was hopeful. And like I said, it started off really interesting. After a couple of weeks, it was like, wow. And then it started leveling out. And then you started losing these nuances and this minutia that the cocoa brought to the piso, and it all just kind of ended up being painted with a broad brush. But you learn. And if the test kitchen wants to use it, we can start it up very quickly again and maybe just age it to 3 weeks. It should be very young for a miso, but...
When you're finishing, you just literally put them in the fridge and they just kind of hang there.
We freeze them.
Oh, okay.
We vacuum seal them and freeze them, which definitely stops the fermentation. But they would still age slowly in the fridge as well.
But this one here is a verbena pea, which again, I'm imagining a little bit like the citric. You've got this, is that, did that?
Well, another thing that we do with our pisos, to flavor them, you don't want anything too wet. You don't want anything that's going to ruin the moisture content of the piso. And so we make all our oils at Noma, all our favorite oils. We just use a neutral base, something like grapeseed oil. And in the end of July, at the height of elderflower season, we're harvesting kilos and kilos, buckets and buckets and buckets of elderflower from our foragers, and we're blending it into elderflower oil. But from that leftover pulp, after the oil is hung and drained through a cheesecloth, we take that oily mash, wring it out, and then fold it through our pisos at a low ratio to flavor them. And you find that these tastes get fermented along with the peas, and you end up with something very different from what it went in, but still recognizably of the character of its original form, just a little more interesting, you could say.
You see, what I've noticed here, since I got here, is this kind of layer upon layer upon layer. You're like the millefeuille of cuisine.
You could say that.
Yeah. It's always, there's this sort of layering. I think, it sounds very strange, but I've noticed throughout you're using these napkins. You've got this rose piso here, and you use the napkins over the top of them, and there's something quite artisanal about this.
You could say we're artisans, absolutely.
Yeah, no, but it's sort of science and crazy kind of microbial kind of cerebral thought process that comes in and meets this kind of get your hands on it. It's art, it's not just food, it's just art.
Yeah, and if you knew how finicky the pisos were to make, yes, it would be, you would recognize it as an art.
You're an artist.
We try.
Can I record kind of some sounds of you opening them up and kind of some sounds and spoons clanking and kind of things? Because then what often happens is that my producer will take a sound and kind of tease people into the program. And if you know that, because I heard you doing earlier, you were like, do you want to do this, isn't this? So, you know. So can I have a
sure. Sort of I'll just do it right
here. Clanking, picking up buckets and...
That's a good batch.
I think that's probably one of the nicest things I've ever put in my mouth.
Yeah, that's a tasty batch.
Wow. That's the craziest. That's you've captured the elderflower like I've never caught it like that.
Mm-hmm.
Never. It's like you're actually eating the elderflower.
You are though.
No, but I mean, you know, David, you are actually an actual real-life genius. Do you know that?
Yeah, I'm just a sorcerer's apprentice. I guess I've been taught a lot by the people who started all this. I just run with it. goes here. Good moisture content. There's not a lot of tamari on top. That means it's going well.
Explain tamari to me.
Tamari is, in Japan, kind of like this very highly sought after soy sauce. It's actually all the liquid that gets pressed out of making miso and floats to the top. You keep miso underweight to keep the air out. This gets a little sour. So that's still also very young. That was only made about a month ago. So it's a while to age.
David, that's just amazing. I tend to think until now as miso as being something very berry savoury.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm instantly thinking that it must be easier to do in the sweets and puddings.
Yeah, yeah, definitely, right. Definitely. Oh, cool.
Right. Fantastic. I just need to get some photographs.
By all means.
Huh?
By all means.
Oh, cool.
So this is the room for lactic fermentations. And these are lactic acid bacteria, lab, as you call them, a whole slew of them. The most well-known is Lactobacillus. That was a guy discovered by Louis Pasteur, and I can't remember the date, I'm no historian, maybe 17-something-something. And he was wondering what made milk sour, and isolated a bacteria that would eat lactose and poop out as its secondary metabolite, lactic acid, which is what's responsible for yogurt, sour cream, creme fraiche. But it's not just one guy working alone. There's a whole slew of bacteria that are slightly halo tolerant. That means resistant to salt, like anaerobic environments, and are very good at souring things. These are the guys responsible for choucroute, for kimchi, for fermented pickles, nuka. Lactic bacteria are everywhere, and they are some of the most used bacteria in the world of fermentation. And we definitely harness them here. Our koji ends up going into a different direction outside of the misos after it's made. We blend it with water, add salt, and then vacuum seal it. It's a shame this is radio because this bag is a really fun thing to look at, but as it sits at around 28 degrees over the course of days, the bacteria start eating the sugars in the liquid and producing lactic acid and carbon dioxide. And your once gasless bag puffs up like a big pillow, like a hot air balloon filled with CO2. It's respiration. It's the same thing that happens when you breathe in oxygen and breathe out carbon dioxide. There are living organisms that need to do the same. Well, they don't need oxygen, they just need sugar. But that's what we have here, and these end up being really complex, sour, delicious products that we clarify and use for their juices. You could blend it into a puree. They are really, really tasty. We do the same for fruits and vegetables. We ferment seaweeds and plums, cherries and berries. We have a few of our cherry scraps that we'll harvest for their juices afterwards, and you end up with a very tart and bright tasting, almost something akin to like a cherry vinegar, but it's not. Plums as well, we end up pureeing them after they're fermented and drying them out like chips. We also make all our kombuchas in this room, just because it's a nice temperature for them here.
The temperature is this room because this is much more ambient.
Yeah, this is around 25 degrees right now. And behind us we have our kombuchas on the bottom shelf.
So David, how long have these been here?
This guy's, let's say the 10th, this has been here for 4 days, he's been here for 5, this will get pulled off today, 4 days as well. Usually 5 to 6, 7 days is kind of your neighborhood for a lactic fermentation to get the acidity that you want.
So do you do the same as you do with mesas? Do you freeze them?
Yes. Yes, because these guys are far more active than the misos are. If you were to keep them in the fridge, in a bag, they'd puff up and you'd have a little hot air balloon in there as well.
You have any explosions in here?
You definitely, yeah. It's something you have to watch over. You check the room every day and vent what you need to vent and reseal it because that carbon dioxide does build up.
Does it come and burp them?
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Just on the complete aside, I've had 2 explosions in the past few weeks.
Yeah.
So yeah, it goes everywhere. Mm-hmm. How much cleaning up do you have to do if one of them explodes?
As much as necessary. Which is usually never simple because there's shelves upon shelves here.
So what happens at that point if you leave them? Is that the acetic acid comes through? Can you make a vinegar out? Is this
lactic acid, which is a very different flavor from acetic acid. But you could use it in much the same way. It's a much brighter, less sharp acidic flavor that doesn't bite the sides of your tongue so much as like coat the top and the back. And you can control it a lot better as well. You can control the production.
With this liquid, I mean, we can't go into break into these bags to taste it right now, but I mean, this is effectively going to have a vinegary taste. Is it going to be, a little bit like, no?
It's a different taste.
Okay. Can we at some point, do you think we can taste at some point?
Sure.
No, I mean, I'm not, don't break into a bag or anything, but.
No, it's easy. How would you taste the plums? Which will be quite nice for us.
You've got plum leaves here.
These are things that are just aging.
Plum as in, is it?
Plum, don't. There's a lot of ESL in this restaurant. English is a second language.
Okay, because I'm just looking at the spelling and thinking, wow, there's
no,
in like plumbing.
No.
Plum.
No lead.
So
no
these are just leaves of plum trees?
Yes.
And what are you?
They're sitting with salt. Or no, these are
plums
with plum leaves.
And can you ferment leaves?
Fermenting green things isn't always tasty.
Your face says that. You're like,
you just kind of end up with like chewed grass, that kind of mulchy, cellulosey. There's lots of things in leafy, rough green plants, roughage, that just doesn't lend itself to breaking down very easily by these bacteria.
What about fig leaves?
They could salt and age very well, and that's something that we do. By adding more salt than even lactic bacteria can take, you just end up salting and other things happen. Just aging, salt seeps in, water kind of comes out, and you end up with this aged flavor. That's a result of different processes.
It's quite interesting because throughout our recordings, we've looked at some incredible fermentations. The one thing that you keep talking about is salt.
Mm-hmm.
Without the salt, what happens?
I put it this way. The difference between a pet and a pest is whether you wanted to have it in your house. The difference between a crop and a weed is whether you wanted it in your field. And the difference between fermenting and rotting is if you wanted that microbe to grow in your food. The only thing that really allows you to control that with any accuracy is salt content. Or just priming your environment to such an extent, over-inoculating, that you've given what you want to grow a head start. Which is the case for the koji, but for things like our misos, for our garums, for our lactic ferments, the salt ratio is critical to keeping out things like botulism, but allowing things like lactobacillus to thrive.
What level of salt do you need in something to keep botulism out, David? Do you know that? Do you
at
have
least
that
around 2%. 2-4% is safe. Below that, it's a bit too sketchy. It's not really an amount of salt that you wouldn't find in an animal's body anyway. But 2% is good for our purposes. It's kind of where you would keep choucroute or kimchi's. Though all the recipes I've read are kind of like, throw in 2 handfuls, but it usually averages out. And these are things that have been, developed over the course of thousands of years.
One of the things I've noticed here is that your salt levels are tightly controlled, and what you're allowing is the flavour to come through. Mm-hmm. So your salt is very controlled.
Yeah, we keep it kind of at the lowest threshold possible to allow us to work with it in as many ways as possible. Maybe we want to reduce the juices of the plums after they're strained and fermented, so you end up with a syrup that's both sour and sweet and salty, but if you add too much salt in there, it'd just be unpalatable. So it is a fine line in being able to control and keep your ferment safe, but also be versatile on the other end with how you cook with them.
With your salt, what kind of salts are you using? Do you change your salt according to ferment? Are you using,
sea salt across the board. Flake sea salt. From Denmark. But, well, in England, looks pretty similar to Malden. Iodine tends to lead to not so nice flavors, so we just go for natural, mineral-rich sea salt.
That's very cool. Plums.
Yeah, I think I left the spoons outside.
I serve fermented peaches with cultured cream and a long, slow fermented, fermented cake as a Victoria classic English Victoria sandwich cake. But everything's fermented for afternoon tea, and people are like, "Oh my god!" It's kind of fun actually.
Still young, not quite there yet.
It is young, and it's got almost like a greenness to it. So
mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's incredibly fruity. Although I can taste that the salt still needs to kind of move to the back foot, if you like. But the smell was fruit, and I think so. How long that kind of transforms? Does it over another? How long would you leave that now?
Another 2 days.
Yeah.
This guy is just about ready. So this is our koji water. This is koji that's been blended with water. 2% salt, and we let it bubble away.
This is just koji and water. Do you use... I imagine that chlorination wouldn't do any favours, or do you just tap water?
Chlorination?
Chlorine in tap water.
We use filtered water. So
that's
a good example.
Ripe apples and bananas.
Yeah.
That's literally koji in water.
Mm-hmm.
Can I get some more?
Yeah, go for it.
And that's what, 2 days old?
No, this is about 5 days old now.
Does the freezing of it have an effect on anything? It just stops it, does it? Or does it carry on? Once you bring it back around, does it carry on? So you freeze it, use it straight away.
Yeah. They absolutely change on the other side as well. All those lactic bacteria don't go anywhere after it's frozen. So if you were to thaw it, it would kick back up.
If I didn't know what that was...
And you wouldn't know what it was.
No, it's just, you know, that would be like there was some kind of like stew fruit.
Yeah.
But obviously much more complex.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got... fermented bananas in it.
There's lots of overlapping means to get to the same flavors via different routes, for sure.
And is that really, I mean, again, is this something you work with the esters? Is this the esters that are kind of creating these flavors?
That's Ariel's department, to be honest.
Okay, so I may need to ask her about the esters, because that's something that I've been asked to So, what's this one?
It's like fermenting celery. I don't know. Maybe that got forgotten. I didn't put this
in. It's like an abandoned orphan.
Yeah, sometimes people start things and that.
And you keep the kombuchas in here as well.
Yeah, so these are all our mother's from things that we have produced.
That's been getting some time, hasn't it?
You just keep feeding them occasionally, but let them just hang out, stay alive.
We've got a cherry stone mother here, and that's a cherry stone kombucha.
Mm-hmm.
So really almond-y.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so it tastes, so you're creating like almond flavours and almost recreating flavours that you couldn't get here in Denmark through your fermentation. Right. How amazing is that?
So this is our vinegar room. And
yeah, it's a fairly pungent room. This is a room that makes a lot of sense to keep by itself because you can smell all this volatile acidity floating in the air.
And this is acetic acid that's wafting out of the buckets, and it's a bit piquant, as they say. These large buckets that we have down low are elder flower wine that we've blended with elder berries and are now fermenting this vinegar, and allowing those berries and the sugars in them to carry through as the acetic acid is produced by acetic acid bacteria. And this is a very straightforward standard process. We made an elderflower syrup last year at the height of elderflower season and let that ferment while we were away in Australia. It came up to maybe about 12-15% alcohol, and then we added an unpasteurized vinegar starter to it, berries, and now these have been aerating slowly. We just use fish pumps. It's a really easy way to speed up the vinegar just by adding more oxygen. And you end up with a really delicious, sweet tasting sour vinegar. So I'll get one for you to taste. Oops.
And that's the elderberries I can see on top.
Yes.
So the difference between this one and that one is obviously one's looking really fizzy and the other one's looking kind of a little bit calmer. Oh wow. Oh heavens, that's so good.
Yeah, it's tasty.
Oh, that's intense. The intensity of that is that flavour is still sitting in my mouth, like it's almost like a bell. It's still ringing.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing for me that I would want to drag a warm sourdough through and just eat that with a little bit of maybe some olive oil. And I need anything else. Mm-hmm. That does it for me. Mm-hmm. So tell me again about. So you made elderflower syrup.
Yes.
What is it that gets that acetic acid going? What I mean, it does it itself. How does it work? How does that kind of?
Well, that's where the unpasteurized vinegar starter comes from. We add an unpasteurized apple vinegar as a starter base, and then that has all of those acetic acids still hanging out within it that can then thrive on the alcohol that was produced by the initial ferment.
Why would that not just become vinegar anyway on its own, just out of interest?
It would, because there's acetic acid floating around in the air. Or acetic acid bacteria floating around in the air.
That's why I'm not understanding why you have to inoculate it with another one. Why?
Because other things can get in there. And like I said, if you're not using salt, then you have to make sure that you're adding enough of the bacteria you want in there that there's going to be a healthy population to keep growing and push out other bacteria that might compete with it. It's quite easy to have very off flavors, to have wild yeasts infect your vinegars and with whatever residual sugar sits in there, add very off musty flavors.
So is there a point at which you're adding that extra vinegar in order to kind of kill off and finish the yeast? Because that acidity will come up to level the yeast.
Well, it had stopped fermenting. I mean, it had kind of reached the point where it was going to go. The wines were dry enough.
Because the alcohol as well will kill off the
exactly,
yeast.
Exactly. It had kind of come up to where it was going to come up to. And so once it stabilized, then we decided to turn it into vinegar. But by adding the elderberries to the second ferment, you know, you add more sugar and there is a chance for more things to come in and start growing.
So you've done your elderflower syrup, then you've added your elderflower berries. This is this layering that I was looking at earlier. Mm-hmm. And then you've added in your...
At the same time.
Okay.
You add the berries and the vinegar starter.
Okay. And so the berries and the vinegar starter are going into the elderflower syrup.
Into the elderflower wine.
Into my elderflower wine. Okay.
And that elder fine's about 15%.
I think it was, yeah. I think it was around there.
Was it good?
It was very good. It was very strong. You didn't see it coming. That was a fun afternoon.
Yeah, I was going to say. That sounds like, yeah, it sounds like half of it wouldn't make it into vinegar if it was in my house.
Yeah.
Sorry. You've got fennel vinegar.
Yeah.
Tell me about this. Is this the same process? You make like a fennel
wine? No,
we
don't make a fennel wine because there's just not enough sugar in the fennel to get that going. What we do is we just get a little bit of, you know, food safe alcohol. You could use like overproof vodka if you wanted. Add that to fennel juice, then add the same vinegar starter, and the vinegar starter will start eating that raw alcohol, and then carrying the fennel flavor through the ferment. Still be a bit boozy. It's only about a week old.
So this is vodka, fennel, and a
unpasteurized vinegar.
What percentage of unpasteurized? It can't be much. It's probably what?
20. It's fairly high.
20%. Okay, because it doesn't have that.
No, it's not enough to really overpower. It definitely lends a hue, but it's not enough to overpower the flavor of the base.
Dave, where's the sweetness coming? Because you haven't heard the sweetness in there.
Well, fennel has some sweetness to it, but our apple vinegar is also a bit sweet as well.
So there's no sugar in there?
No, we haven't added any sugar, no.
Right, okay, because that's unbelievably sweet. I mean, for the ingredients, if I were to... I'm quite surprised at how sweet that is.
Mm-hmm.
And you've used fennel bulbs or fennel...
Fennel bulbs, yeah.
Okay, right, that's the sugar's coming from in the fennel. Okay, I'm thinking cut fennel. That's fine. Right? That's stunning. And that stays, how long does that take?
Until the alcohol really dies off. It feels fairly close, so I might pull it off by the end of this week. And that was about 2 weeks, I would say.
And again, new freezes, or do you put them just in the
we
fridge
freeze.
And kind of store?
Yeah.
If you put them
they do hold very well.
They're quite stable
well.
Vinegars.
Yeah.
Yeah. And these bunks, what do you...
These are airlocks for other things we might make, fermenting honeys, you know, kind of making our own mead-like products. If we do dabble around with making alcohols that eventually turn into vinegar afterwards, we'll use airlocks for that. But handy tools for fermentation, allowing things to get out, but nothing to get in.
Do you know, it sounds, you're talking about it with such familiar terms and you're so kind of, this is what you do. But just taking this in is, it's sort of expanding my brain. I feel like someone's blown my brain up like a balloon and stretched it. Because it's taking everything to that next level. It's beyond, it's always the next step beyond. And I think that's incredible. Have you ever, for a person not here, not for the radio, have you ever done, again, it's one of the things I've been playing with at home, have you ever fermented sourdough to turn that into like a wine and then turn that into a vinegar? Because that's another area I'm playing with.
We have not,
okay.
But we should.
Okay.
Cool.
Okay, I started fermenting and making sourdough vinegars.
Mm-hmm.
Really because somebody came from Russia, one of my students came from Russia, and it kind of came in from the fact that I made this kvass.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like this really common drink that everybody drinks in Russia. And I used a rye, a really kind of dark, heavy rye. And I made my kvass, and then essentially what happened was my kvass got left and it just
vinegared,
and I served that with my sourdough for my students.
Good.
And it's those flavours you can't really describe so much, but it's more watery than I would like it. And one of the things I wanted to do is kind of boil them down.
Well, boiling will kill the acidity.
Yeah. So I haven't, but it's still, it's...
reducing slowly, won't.
How do I reduce
sometimes the acidity is too high. How is it? Because it's just I've left it too.
The acidity
long.
Is too high.
Sometimes
it's just you'd have to water it down, but then you're gonna water down the flavor as well.
Yeah.
You just make a.
So is it just because I've left it too long?
Yeah. Or the alcohol was too high to begin with.
Okay. I'm still learning.
Yeah.
I mean,
the more alcohol there is there, the more food there is for the acetic acid to turn into vinegar. The acetic
okay,
acid
that's
bacteria.
Making more sense, because I hadn't established that connection between the amount of alcohol and the vinegar, the acetic acid. That's something I haven't quite connected. So the alcohol is effectively food.
Yeah.
For acetic
yeah.
acid. It's like you're putting pieces of jigsaw puzzles together for
it
me.
Is. Oh, okay. Yeah,
but
sure.
For me,
yeah.
personally,
yeah.
It's like someone's just kind of just slotted a missing piece in there for me, because I'm not, I'm like, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This is, I love this. Can I try this on the couch?
Well, I don't know.
Is it not?
It's from before my time.
Okay. You're looking very suspicious. Don't worry, if you think that's going to be revolting, we won't. What else have we got here? Celery vinegar.
These are going slowly, I don't think they're done yet.
So how, okay, so in length of time, because I'll tell you the other one I accidentally made as well. The Chinese students that come to me, and they make their sourdough using fermented fruit. They don't use a sourdough starter.
Mm-hmm.
They have a special name for it, and it's quite... So they don't have starter, they don't have sourdough starter, they literally ferment the fruit, it's completely fermented, and then they make the bread with that water.
Mm.
It's quite an interesting process.
What fruit?
Well, cherries, mainly.
Oh.
Plants and cherries. I've been playing around with that, and again, inadvertently made vinegars through just kind of leaving them, and then I've kind of, like, you know, not used all of them, and I have these really kind of... I use kiln jars and they've just become vinegar, which is why I was interested into why you were adding in the apple, because obviously now I understand why, because I haven't, I've just left them and they've just done themselves, and again trying to control the flavour, I haven't done enough to understand how to control my flavour with them. What I hadn't appreciated is I've got a herb garden. And I've got the most beautiful, I've told you, 2/3 of an acre of gardens. And I don't think that I'm making enough use, because one of the things that's really blown me away is the fennel. Because I have the herb, I can make my own herb vinegars. But my father and my mother, a mile away, have the UK's top vineyard. My dad planted it, he's now 74 now. It's called Fleur Fields, and they make all their own wine, and it's a boutique vineyard, and we produce about 5,000 bottles, and again, it's something that, so I have access to the grapes, and this piece is there as well. We pick once a year and make the vinegar. So my dad does, you know, I've been playing with making his wine into vinegar. So, but sometimes it's hard to know how to control the flavors when you're on your own. Because
yeah.
I'm literally on my own sometimes, just
yeah.
kind of scratching my head.
Trial and
sorry.
It's a lot of trial and error.
Still self-teaching,
yeah.
And I think it's what I find here at Noma that is just probably the reason I push myself out is because I can't learn anymore. You get to a point on your own where
yeah.
you just don't learn anymore. You just make a mistake. You make the same mistake. You make same mistake, you start reading, and it's only really when you push yourself right out of your own, you know, it's all very well being in that place, but on your own, and there's no one to share it with, and half the fun of this is the sharing, it's that interaction, and I miss that, really miss it. It's something that whenever I come here or somewhere like Tartine, I often walk away and I actually get a bit teary, saying, oh, shit, those amazing minds all kind of coming together like an orchestra, and I find that really hard. And so one of the things I'm doing, the reason I built school, is because I can pull everybody in from all over the world.
More of that.
Yeah. And it's something that I don't really give a shit about money. Whatever. But just being able to just stand in here and look at what you're doing on a personal level, I find that incredibly inspiring. Really inspiring. You just in this moment, you've kind of really set me on fire with those things where you're pushing these vinegars. I'm having a
really
inspired me, David.
That's good.
Yeah. 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 I'm, good. I'm, job. No, yeah. It's just, you know, watch the pebble. You just tucked in my palm. I feel like sending you little messages going, look! Or can you come over and then just come have a play?
Yeah.
You're really arming your chefs here, aren't you? You're literally arming your chefs.
We make more
chefs.
Stuff. We make more stuff.
Like ammunition, aren't you?
That's kind of what we
Yeah.
As Lars once put it, it's my job to just make cool shit. Let them figure it out.
If you enjoyed listening to that podcast as much as I enjoyed chatting with my guests, then you might like to find out a little bit more about what I do. Well, I teach courses both online and in person at thesourdoughschool.com. I also write regularly for sourdough.co.uk. And I have a couple of Instagram accounts that you might like to follow. Sourdough School, Sourdough Club. Oh, and I have a personal one, Vanessa Kimball. I really do love to hear people's thoughts and feedback about, well, the books I write, the podcast, the features, or if you have any questions, don't hesitate to get in touch. Thank you for listening.